Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
What's actually happening tonight? Bit of a special treat for you. Brian Brown, actor, producer, author, larrikin, much loved Aussie icon. He's been in over 100 film and TV productions. He's worked in 20 different countries, including here at home. But his talents aren't just stage, screen, big and small. A couple of years ago, he started writing fiction, crime fiction in particular. Sweet Jimmy was 7 short stories on crime. That came out in 2021. The Drowning was his first novel. That came out in 2023. And this year, it was his second thriller, titled The Hidden. He delivered a literary lunch recently in Sydney to talk all about it and his writing. And we're going to bring you that discussion in the first hour. And then through the next few weeks, we're chatting to our ABC political reporters, looking back over the big news stories that they've been covering in their respective states, territories and regions all across 2025. And Liberal leadership in Victoria was one of the big headlines for that state. And Richard Willingham is the state political reporter in Melbourne, so second hour, taking a look at some of those stories that were right across the ABC Victoria airwaves. And then Ian Verenda, ABC's chief business correspondent, he's going to come and chat to you about the announcement from the federal government about its gas reservation policy. This is an effort from the Albanese government to drive down domestic energy bills while preventing shortfalls. And Ian's going to explain everything that's involved here. And also in the second hour, have you done your Christmas cooking? You might be working on something while listening to me. You might be gearing up to throw together a really big spread tomorrow. So tonight, some suggestions, and maybe if not for Christmas Day, maybe at least for next year, even Christmas in July. Naomi Crisanti, she is an award-winning food stylist and educator. She's going to be chatting kind of Australian Christmas dishes, the classics, the left of field, the last minute options. I'm going to get stuck into some fabulous ideas about the best meals for your family spread this Christmas. And then the Mighty Challenge. Look, given the date, there's a pretty strong theme across the 5 categories. You're going to have to stick around and find out what that is. And in our issue of the day, it's a big question. It's a very personal question in a weird way. I want to know what you are going to be cooking over the Christmas run. Is there a huge spread with the classics? Is it leg of lamb, leg of ham, roast chicken, the full turkey, all the trimmings, everything in between? Or do you have like a family tradition of coming together to cook something? Maybe something from a nan's cookbook or maybe a dish that only comes out once a year. We're going to talk all about that in the last hour of the program.
This is Nightlife with Nick Ealy on ABC Radio.
Brian Brown, very multi-talented man. He is an actor, he is a producer, and now a crime fiction author. His second novel, The Hidden, came out recently. It centres on a small village on the New South Wales north coast. It's got drug running, bikie gangs, coke shipments, and dead roosters in a forest. It is very intriguing stuff. And here is Brian speaking at a recent literary lunch about his writing, his shift from working in insurance to acting, how he became a star, husband to Rachel Ward, and it's all introduced and interviewed by journalist and author of 3 novels, Cassie Hamer.
I feel like we're so lucky to be here in the presence of an Australian acting icon and a very, very talented writer as well. At an age where, you know, fair enough, some people are slowing down, Brian only appears to be speeding up. There's not many people on this planet who could say that they've appeared both in a feature film and released a book all in the same month. I love what your good mate Sam Neill says about your writing. He says, "My friend Brian Brown, quite apart from his other manifold talents, turns out to be an excellent writer. An authentic voice, highly imaginative yet completely believable. A great storyteller. This is utterly baffling. I'm furious."
I wish I could have said the same about him.
You are very talented, but it's fair to say that you don't need to write. You're not doing it for the money. So the question is, why are you doing it? Why pick up the pen at this stage?
How it came about was, look, I've been telling stories for over 50 years. As an actor, as a producer, I've worked with writers, for many years. I've helped shape stories that I've been involved in. One evening, I was sitting watching CNN, and there was what they called a celebratory dinner in Hong Kong. And there was about eight people at this dinner, and they'd all just been released from jail. And the judge had said, "You're not drug mules, you're stupid." And they'd all been caught in scams, carrying things in that they didn't know about. And I looked at that and I thought, if I was one of those people, I'd want to know who did this to me. And then I thought, very good idea for a series, Brian. So I decided to start writing that story. I chose a fella that had been one of those, a bloke from Sydney who wasn't a cop, who had to try and pursue this. So I started writing the story. And I kept writing it, mainly because what I do is I get to a certain stage on it and then I go and pitch it to a television station or a studio or whatever. But I was enjoying writing this story and I sort of wanted to see where the story would go. And in the end, I had 17,500 words. And it's a short story. And Jenny Byrne, the journalist who's a good friend of mine, she read it and she said, "It's a very good story and I like how you write it. Do you have any others?" 30 years ago, I did exactly the same thing as a pitch. I came up with this idea of a story of an Australian couple who go to America to go on a driving trip around America. They go to Vegas and they leave there, but they break down, they get kidnapped, and it's how they get caught up in outside of Vegas. So I went back and looked at that where I had written that story. And I was surprised by the style. It was very similar style to how I wrote. And I didn't ever think about style. I just put my stories down how I felt them. But I went, oh, that's interesting. So I sharpened that up a bit. And so I had two stories then. And then, of course, and Richard Walsh, who's connected to Alan and Unwin, he read them and he said, "Look, if you've got any more, we could..." I'm sure Alan and Unwin would like to publish them. And I thought, well, I haven't got any more. But, of course, once that's inside your head, I'm driving down the road, you know, and I go, what if Sam Neill was a thief? Well, he'd be useless, let me tell you that. However, I had a statement, I had a thing, Sam the thief. Who is Sam and who is and what has he stolen? And so I then developed a story. So by the end of it, I had seven stories. And they were published by Alan Armand. So that led me to writing, to putting a story down that way. But I did not think I'd then go and write a novel. And, of course, it's once again, once you start something, it's festering in your head and you start to go, well, maybe there's something in this. And the next minute, the drowning and the same sort of thing happened with The Hidden.
So it seems like you're developing your own sort of genre, which I would call coastal crime. And the latest book, The Hidden, does continue in the vein of The Drowning. I think the setting is really important to the book. So we've all driven through those sort of slightly sleepy-seeming North Coast towns where you've got beautiful waves, golden sand, everything seems quite benign. So what Brian does in his book is he gives us that setting, which is called The Heads, but he then looks beneath the surface to where all the action is going on. And there is a lot of action going on in this book. There's drugs. Drugs seem to be the main problem. There's a creep who is really preying on the women of the town. There's mistreatment of animals going on. And yet it's all balanced by some really tender relationships as well. So I'm wondering, Brian, you've got a property on the North Coast. Is that the inspiration for the book? Well, and what's going on up there?
Well, my wife's a drug dealer. What I find, I've spent over 40 years travelling backwards and forwards and being up the North Coast in the Nambucca Valley, that area, all around there, and Coffs and whatever. And I feel that place pretty good because I surf there and I've surfed Scotts and Crescent Heads and I've got after a surf, have a coffee with the ladies that surf there or the blokes that surf there. And you've got to have a pensioner's ticket to surf there anyway, you know, like... but everyone, the more I get to know people, the more stories come out. You know, like, you just, you realise that everybody has a story. And from the person you least expect will come the most surprising story always. And it's wonderful unravelling and finding those stories. So I find that when I deal with the North Coast, and also I can see the pictures in my head for the setting, you know. And you got to say, I'm not a very flowery writer, so I don't particularly describe the places, but I do try to give a sense of the place. So that's why I like that. Of course, the thing about country towns that I like is that everyone knows everything about everyone, except they don't. And it's the except they don't that I like mucking around with in a book.
So in this particular book, we start with a pretty heartbreaking scene where a little boy witnesses his mother overdosing and dying from drugs. And then we take up with probably our main character, who's the local cop, who's looking into this and really wants to delve into the reasons why this woman has become hooked on drugs and who's been supplying it. You mentioned there that you can visualise the setting in your head. I wonder, when you're writing, are you seeing it as a movie and translating it from your brain to the keys in that way?
No, I don't think I am. But, of course, you touch on the fact that I've been involved with movies, television, the screen all my life. So there's a visual aspect to it that I think is maybe just natural to the medium that I've worked in for so long. Yeah.
You said before that you don't use flowery language, but I think a nicer way to term it would be that you're very deft at creating character portraits. So we know exactly, we can visualise someone in a matter of a few words. And what's so nice about your books as well is that when I'm reading it, I feel like you are the one reading it to me, because it's exactly that dry, laconic Australian voice that we'd all expect to hear. It is interesting that you've chosen to focus on the crime genre, because I think in a sliding doors reality, there was a chance in your early life that you could have turned to petty crime into something more serious, because it wasn't the easiest childhood. So you're born in 1947 to Molly and Jack, I think it was, Molly and Jack Brown. Your dad had already had one family. At the age of two, he abandoned your family as well. And from there, your mum has to take up work to keep the family going. And so she takes in cleaning. She's a piano accompanist for the local ballet school. You know, things are pretty tough. But I feel like your mum is the person who stood between you and going down a wayward track. What kind of a woman was Molly Brown? Sorry.
You're trying to make me cry, aren't you? She was the best. I owe her everything. Every single thing. As does my sister. And the older I get, the more I go, how did you do it? No brothers and sisters. Parents had died by the time she was 16. Her devotion to the pair of us was extraordinary. There was never a bloke around. She never had another boyfriend or any man came around. She was community-minded. It's funny in that period too how important the church was to us all. You know, that would be where the local priest was, where someone would go to if they wanted to say, is there anyone in the area that can clean? And he would say, get in touch with mum or someone else. Dances on a Friday night, mum would play piano at that. So it was very community minded. And as many people here knows, like on a Saturday, you'd go out, your mother would never see you again. You'd be playing in other people's homes. And you'd be getting a sandwich by Mrs. Marr up the road or whatever. You were out and about. You were a part of things. You were adventurous. But also, that adventurousness could get you into trouble. Look, it was a working class area where I grew up at the end of the suburbs, but I did have situations where I had a couple of mates that ended up in jail when they were 17 and 18. That sort of thing where you'd nick a Mars bar from the local shop. It's more a game than anything else. You know, look, I got a Mars bar, or you'd take an orange or something. Okay, one-off sort of thing. It's like, got away with that. But that someone could then say to a kid like that, listen, Mr. So-and-so over the road, he's gone away for the weekend and his mower's sitting out there. If we got that, we can probably sell that down the pub for £5. And then the person does that. And then there's another step. Is that kid going to get a smack across the ears from his father or the local cop and sort him out and he won't do it again? Or are you on a road to real strife and criminality later on? It's not hard to get into trouble. It's hard to get out of it once you're in it. And so I'm always aware. In my first book, Sweet Jimmy, one of the stories is inspired. I used to surf at Shelley Beach near Cronulla when I was a young bloke, when I was 15, 14, 16, something like that. My mates and I, we'd go surfing there. And there were two boys that used to come along at about 10 o'clock in the morning to surf there. And they'd been coming for over the past 4 or 5 months or whatever. But every time they came there, they'd have a new jacket on or a new pair of surf shorts, and they knocked them off from surf, dive and ski. They'd go in, get dressed in them and wander out, and they'd tell us this. Now, a huge part of us was like admiring, my God, they did that, like, wow, I mean, that's exciting and they got away with it. And then the other part of us is like, but that's stealing, it's wrong. But like, it was also exciting at the same time. It was really a hard one. Over the years, I've always wondered what happened to those two boys. Was that the beginning of a life that ended up really disastrously in jail for many years? So in Sweet Jimmy, I wrote a story about those two boys, how I saw where that could go to. So that sort of vulnerability that we have interests me enormously. And particularly in getting into trouble, how easy it is to get into trouble. Yeah.
I have a feeling, though, that you just wouldn't have got into trouble for fear of disappointing your mum. And you've said, you know, that you feel that you owe your mum everything. You also owe the suburbs everything. And the other thing, though, that was going for you was that you were pretty good at school. Like, you're a pretty good student. I've heard you say that you hated English, which is a bit of a surprise given where you've ended up. But you were good enough to be offered a scholarship to university, which you turned down in favour of going to work for AMP to be trained as an actuary of all things. Now, that really didn't float your boat, but there was one thing that AMP did for you, and that was that you joined their drama club and they would put on a review. Can you tell me, what was that first experience of acting like for you? How did it feel?
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? As a lot of people here would know, those big companies, you know, you worked there for 40 years. You met your partner there. You got your mortgage there, you know. But they also had a responsibility to make sure that they had social activities for their people there. So there'd be a skydiving club, there'd be a motor racing club, there'd be a dance club, there'd be whatever. And the AMP had a drama club. And a note went round to us all. This was after I'd been working there for about 4 years, just before I turned 21. And a note went round saying they were doing an end-of-the-year review, which meant they were going to send up the bosses but also do different skits that had been written. And if anyone wanted to audition, to come on up. So I said to this mate of mine, who was a bit of a larrikin there, I said, we got to go up. Let's go up to this. There's got to be girls there we haven't met yet. And so we went up. He looked at the piece. We were handed a piece of paper and they said, we're going to get you to read opposite someone with this soon. He looked at that and he went, I'm not for it. And he ducked out. So I looked at the piece of paper, read it, and then I had to read it opposite someone. And at the end of it, they said, Look, if you want to be in the review, we're happy to have you. And I said, oh, that'd be good. And they said, be at rehearsals after work tomorrow afternoon. Now, I enjoyed going to work. I enjoyed the train ride from Penang to Circular Quay. I enjoyed being around people. I enjoyed the fact I was earning some money. I could have a bit of my own life. I enjoyed all that. I enjoyed working in an office and talking to people and all that. It was convivial. I liked all that. But that next morning when I woke up, I couldn't wait to go to work because I was going to do this thing called rehearsal that I didn't have a clue what it was, but I knew it was a place that I wanted to be at. And so a need that I didn't know I had was going to be looked after at this place called rehearsal.
The way you talk about it, it seems like it was almost a feeling of euphoria. You've said that it was a moment where things really clicked and started to make sense. Is that how it was?
I felt incredibly comfortable, in the best way. Not comfortable like lazy, don't want to do anything, but like, God, this is good being. It's like if some of you probably play golf and you're on the golf course and you hit a good stroke and you go, today's about the best day. Yeah. But it was, I felt very comfortable there and I don't know why. I was very lucky because at that stage I'd looked around the AMP and I'd seen I said to someone, who are those blokes that have the good suits and the sharp cars? And I said, oh, they're the salesmen. And I went up to the boss and I said, I want to be a salesman. Now, the lucky thing about that was, and I became a salesman, but the lucky thing about that was, as a salesman, as many of you know, no one knows where the hell you are during the week as long as you get your figures in on a Friday. And because I did this review, I did the review, and I loved doing it. I felt great doing it. And I wanted to do it some more. And someone told me about an amateur theatre in Sydney called the Genesian Theatre in Kent Street. And I went and joined that, and I found that I was spending all my time there. I gave up surfing. I gave up playing rugby league on weekends. I was at rehearsal. I acted in shows. I worked backstage and all that. And it took up my time. But I wanted to be there, and I'd found something a place that was the right place for me to be.
And so you're really loving that amateur theatre work, and at some point, at 25, I think it was, you decide to sell the car and try your luck in London in the acting scene. And I believe that you had a friend who knew someone in the theatre world. What was their role and how did they help you break in?
Well, I did. I decided I'd go to England and become an actor because when I was in amateur theatre, I'd go to the old tote or whatever it was in Sydney, and I'd see English and American plays, and I saw Australian actors playing American or English. I didn't see Australian plays. I didn't see an Australian play in Australia. And I looked at that and I thought, well, I'm not going to do it secondhand. I'll go to England, I'll become a POM. So, yeah, I sold my car, bought a ticket, went to England. And one of the first places, you could have two stops. One was Hong Kong and one was Athens. Got off in Athens, had a week, got on a ferry out to Mykonos. And as soon as you arrived at Mykonos, then there'd be a lady there selling you a bed for a dollar or something in a house. And so you'd go there. The house I was in, there was about six other blokes were staying there. A couple of Irish blokes who just got through as doctors. But one of the young blokes that was there lived in the council houses in Chelsea. And so he got talking. And he said, why are you going to England? I said, I want to be an actor. I want to be in the theatre. And he said, oh, my dad's in the theatre. And I went, ding. Oh, yeah? What's he do? He said, he's a fireman. Now, in the theatres in England, and any of you that have been there, there's a big fire screen that comes down at the end of all shows, and it's a protective thing. And so there's a fireman in every English theatre in London. And this is what I put down to, I think, the way I grew up. I think someone else would have, when that person said he's a fireman, they would have, wouldn't have meant anything. But I went, I've just got to get in the theatre. If I've got to clean toilets, I don't care. I've got to get in because I'll find my way as long as I get in there. And so I looked up his father when I went to London. And his father, lovely fellow, he said, come on down. He said, I'll introduce you to the chief fireman. Introduced me to the chief fireman. The chief fireman wrote out a letter, said, take that to the union. Went to the union. The union gave me a set of cards and they said, you're pushing scenery at the Victoria Palace tonight. And so I wasn't cleaning toilets. I was pushing scenery. And, of course, there were people pushing scenery there. There was a young actor who was out of work and he said to me, if you want to get ahead, you've got to write to the provinces to try and get a job in the provinces because you can't work straight away in London. And I was told everyone I was an actor in Australia, and I wasn't, of course. And so that was the journey. You know, that's how I got into it. And then I did audition. I did get parts. And, you know, for my final year in 1974, I got the opportunity to audition for Peter Hall, who'd taken over the National Theatre of Great Britain from Laurence Olivier. I got the opportunity to audition for him, and I got a year's contract at the National. And so my life was set, except I came back to see my mum for a month's holiday, and Peter Weir was making Picnic at Hanging Rock. David Williamson was writing plays. I went to the Nimrod, and there was a play called How Does Your Garden Grow by Jim McNeil about a prison. And I looked at those things and I went, they're all playing Australians. They're not playing English or Americans. It was beyond exciting. And I didn't go back.
Thank goodness for us, I would say.
You're on Nightlife across the nation on this Christmas Eve with me, Nicholas Healy, Nick Healy to everyone who knows me well. You're hearing a literary lunch with Brian Brown, actor turned very successful crime fiction writer, and it's journalist and author Cassie Hamer who's having a chat with him. We'll hear a bit more now because they talk a lot about how he met his wife and some of his highlights in terms of the roles he's discovered and what it's been like moving between acting and writing.
Obviously, Breaker Morant was also a big breakout role for you, and working with Bruce Beresford for the first time, who you've recently reunited with for The Travellers. But that movie really caught the attention of Hollywood, and that's when you got invited to perform in The Thornbirds. Now, that's an important mini-series for a number of reasons. One is that it brought you into contact with a beautiful young English actress called Rachel Ward. What were your first impressions of Rachel?
She might get lucky. Well, pretty hard to ignore her. But we were working, having to do the Thornbirds, which was a big show, a very big show. And I'd done some miniseries and some other things back home. I'd done A Town Like Alice. I'd done some The Breaker and some other things. And I thought, you know, as much as I thought, very attractive lady, I thought, I'm not going to get myself involved here because if it all falls apart, then how the hell do we work together in that situation? And her being the star and me not being the star, I know who's going to get, you know, who's going to be in control of all this. So we had a number of scenes. She couldn't work out why I was so slow. I just told her that's the Australian way. Anyway, I decided that I wasn't going to make any sort of move during this show at all. Until there was a scene coming up after about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, where we're in a dam and we kiss. And I thought, there's no way I'm getting involved with this girl until that dam. So we did the dam and then we got involved.
And I think you told her from the start that you knew you were going to be together and have three kids. True?
Yeah, someone had told me that on a woman's wrist there's a number of lines. I can't remember who told me this. Bloody good story, though. There's lines, and it says how many children you're going to have. So we were sitting around during waiting for a take or something, and I said, here, give us your hand. And I said, oh, look, you're going to have three children. Well, we've got three kids. You know, and also, how cool a line is that?
Well, she did get lucky in the end. She got you, so that was lucky for her. So you did marry and you've got some kids and you're getting some big Hollywood films, you know, Gorillas in the Mist with Sigourney Weaver takes you to Rwanda with all the gorillas. You got Cocktail with Tom Cruise that took you to Jamaica. But ultimately, you and Rachel really, in a way, turned your back on that and decided to settle and work here in Australia. Why was that?
It's a good question, and it's not really simple to answer. A few things come into play. I remember, and first of all, the American people are so warm. And so health. Anyone that's been to America, the people are lovely to you or whatever. So it was very nice and everything. But in the game that I'm in, I just smelt that. And I came from, like, excitement. We just developed our own industry. It was bloody exciting. We were just putting Australians on screen. That was really exciting to do. And I just felt that it was all about money and power. I could feel that. And there's nothing wrong with both those things, but I felt that was what was being pushed rather than creativity or whatever. Now, that can be naive or whatever. They go hand in hand. But that was always something that was always just a little, not even jarring, but just didn't sit totally right. Rachel didn't like LA. She didn't like LA at all. It's a strange place. We're starting to have children. And I was like, where do you want the kids to grow up? Where do we want the kids to grow up? And we decided we preferred them to, instead of growing up in LA, we wanted them to grow up at home. So, and that was a big step for her because she's English. So she was saying, but she was the one that said, let's go back to Sydney and live there. And so we came back with the children. Of course, different jobs did still come up after that, but you've taken yourself out of the thing. And I started to produce movies at that stage too, so I was building a whole other world that I was enjoying, and so basically that's where we set up 40 years ago.
So I think what I'm hearing is that authenticity and truth is something that's always been a fundamental value to you, and I'm wondering how that translates into your storytelling, both your acting and your writing. How do you know when that you're getting it right?
I don't know that I'm getting it right. I know that I'm doing it how I want to. That's what I know. And it's like, as an actor, let me tell you, when they say action in a movie or television, it's the happiest place I can be. It's playtime. It's back at school. I'm playing. It feels great, you know, regardless of what the thing is or how you got to make it. But I enjoy enjoy all that, but you know I've got to feel. Once again, I come back to that thing. Comfortable. I'm comfortable within that character I've got to play. I can feel him this way. I can talk him that way. I can walk him. It feels right. I was doing a play at this just to sort of show you how things can work or not. I was doing a play at the Sydney Theatre Company about 8 years ago, David Williamson's Travelling North. And we were coming up to the preview, the first night's preview. And so there'd been a lot of rehearsal and Greta Scarkey was meant to do it. And up until 2 days beforehand, Greta fell over in Bondi and hurt her back and had to pull out. So it was, do we cancel the whole show or get someone else? Now, we've got this lovely Alison White from Tasmania, who's a wonderful actress, to step in. Anyway, so we cancelled one preview, and then we got the next preview. We were ready to do it with her reading from the book. And I remember it was like I'm waiting in the wings to start. Anyway, it's time to start, and I start the play, and I walk on saying something like, "Can you hear the coal trains coming through the valley there?" It's something like that, right? As I'm saying to her, as she's there. And of course, I walk in and I say something the wrong way round. Now, it still makes sense, but I say it the wrong way round. And so all I can think of while I'm now talking is I've said that the wrong way round. I've said that the wrong way round. And that's going to stay in there for the whole play, or at least for the next 15 minutes. This ain't good enough. So I stopped and I said, "Sorry, I'm going to start this again." And I walked off. And so I had to change the lights and do the whole thing and then walk back on and set it the right way. But the fact was, it was now not going to be real to me doing it with this other thing in my head. I had to be able to be that bloke, properly relaxed in that. Of course, as soon as I walked back on, the audience cheered. And then they laughed at everything I said. And then at the end of the play, Andrew Upton, who was the director, said to me, "Just remember, the play isn't as funny as that."
That sounds excruciating, I have to say, but you pulled it together. Now, in a minute, we are going to have questions from the audience, but I just want to ask one last one, which is, you know, you're a kid from public housing in Panania. By anyone's standards, you've had an extraordinary life and career, but of all the things, you know, the 100-odd plays and films, the 40-year-plus marriage, the kids, the grandkids, which one makes you the most proud?
Outside of the Dragons winning in 2010. Films give me a lot of things. I've filmed in 20 countries, and because of film, I've probably been to 40. And I've enjoyed an enormous lot of wonderful... I've sung with Paul McCartney, for Christ's sake, in a movie called Give My Regards to Broad Street, where we had to sing Zippity Doodah together in the toilets of the BBC. I mean, excuse me? But you get access to some extraordinary places and stuff. And yes, I got the chance to do Gorillas in the Mist with Sigourney Weaver, go to Rwanda, to the top of a mountain, and every day for 2 weeks, just Sigourney, myself, the cinematographer and the focus puller, and a research assistant who had worked for Deanne Fossey before she died, we followed those gorillas every day for 10 days over 2 weeks, from the morning till the afternoon, filming them, and I was playing a National Geographic photographer in it, and I was as closer than you are to me. They were around us. We moved amongst them. The first day we went up there, I was scared. I didn't know what would happen. People said to me, "It'll be all right, just be submissive." That wasn't going to be hard. So we walk up, and eventually we get to where just the others had to all wait, you know, a kilometre back away from this. We walked up and we went. They said, "All right, start." And I was a National Geographic photographer in it, so I'm meant to be filming the gorillas. So they said, "Okay." Cinematographer said, "Okay, get going." So I take a camera, and I'm now moving amongst them with my back to them and photographing them like that and moving around all the time, waiting for that big paw to come on there, you know, and tomorrow in the paper go, "Australian actor has head ripped off shoulders, thrown off mountain." Never happened before. But it didn't happen. And it was the most extraordinary experience. And when I came down that first day, the crew said to me, "So what was it like? Tell us what it was like." And I didn't have a word. Because, first of all, I was glad I was alive. Secondly, it was extraordinarily thrilling. Thirdly, you're overwhelmed by the beauty and the majesty and the power of these. Fourthly, by the simplicity. There was the big silverback and the wives and the little ones, and they were just like a family. So they're just a family on an outing, walking up, eating trees. So there was all these things that were coming at me that was impossible to explain in a word. But it was only because I'd got into film that I was able to experience, to have that experience. And I turned 40 while I was up there. And I was saying to someone, if someone had said to me, where do you think you'll turn 40? I would never have said on the top of a mountain in a country called Rwanda in Africa, surrounded by a bunch of gorillas. I may have said, on the moon, because at that stage, people went to the moon. That could have made sense, but not to say I was going to be surrounded by a bunch of gorillas on the top of a mountain. And that was a pretty fabulous thing to think happened to me at 40.
Sure, your kids will be happy to know that you may be more proud of the gorillas than them, but we'll let that go. It was a great story. Now, we are going to go to audience questions. So who'd like to put their hand up? I certainly have. Oh, great. Here we go.
Hi, Brian. It's just thrilled. I'm so thrilled to be here, to hear you. Like your wife, I'm English. Love everything Australian. How come, like your mate Sam Neill, you've not tried to do the American accent and all that stuff? Because I just love the fact you've stayed Australian.
So the question was that how come you've decided to always act with your Australian accent where your mate Sam Neill has sort of done different characters, different accents, etc.?
Well, you know, many Australian actors do play Yanks and stuff and Poms and whatever. Look, I remember the first film I was offered in Hollywood, which was a film called FX, which is about a special effects man in New York. It was quite a cult, terrific movie. And I was offered it. And so on the first day of the set, when they say action, I just started talking. No one said, be a Yank. It was written as an American. You know, it was always meant to be, but I just started talking and no one ever said don't. And the same thing happened with Cocktail, a movie I did with Tom Cruise. You know, I was a bartender. It was written as an American bartender, but I just started talking and no one said, change your accent. So, and I go back to that thing about what it was like beforehand here, when you had to go and watch an Australian actor be English or American. I guess I never wanted to have that happen to me again, for that to be part of it. I felt like I had every right to be a lawyer overseas or a doctor or a prisoner or with my sensibilities in my way. So it never happened that anyone told me not to do it, you know.
Now, just before we get to the next audience question, on behalf of the ladies in the room, I do want to know, what is Tom Cruise like? Is he really short? Is he actually good looking? Is he a bit odd or is he just very charismatic? Or all of the above?
Well, you got to know he was 25 when I worked with him, right? So he's a young man. He'd just come off the big plane one. Top Gun. He just come off Top Gun. Look, he was just a delightful fellow, respectful. We used to argue a lot in the car about things, and he'd go, why do we always argue? You know, why do you think the opposite of me? I said, because I'm 40. Right. But we had a very, very nice relationship and very, very respectful, just a very nice, we had a great time together. The thing that I got to give Tom a lot of credit for is that, like, he does a lot of stunts and things like that, right? And he gives it everything and probably develops them and comes up with the ideas of what he wants. But I did a movie called Cocktail that's set in a bar in New York. In that movie, we throw bottles around all sorts of ways, catch them behind our back, throw them and all that. That was never written in the script. And Tom went out one Friday night in New York and he saw a bloke doing that in the bar, and he came back on the Monday at rehearsal and he said, look, I've seen this. Why don't we do that? And the director said, well, that's okay with me if you think you can do it. And what about you, Brian? I said, yeah, I'm happy to have a go at it. And so we then started training about how to do all that. And that was the big thing that lifted that movie to be an entertaining movie. And it also enabled me to get free drinks for about 10 years all over the world.
Well worth the training then. Okay, more questions? Yeah, over here.
Okay. Hello, Brian. My name is Rhonda. This lady here is my new best friend, which we've bonded with over lunch. Hello, darling. What's your name?
Giselle.
My new best, Giselle. And the thing that we bonded about was Sweet Jimmy. We just loved that book. We loved the way it started and then finished at the end. It was that lovely cyclic thing that is so satisfying, I think, for a reader. The other thing that I love, and maybe you do too, Giselle, I'm not sure, because even though we're just best friends now, the thing that I loved most about the way that you wrote was obviously the way that you speak, but also the way that my father used to speak. And I love the rhyming slang. I love the talking and the thinking and the, you know, coming and whatever it is. I just love the way that you speak because it reminds me so much. And the other thing that I love, of course, is the rhyming slang. That's terrific. And I just think that you have this voice which is really so much the Australian, laconic, understated male thing, which is so interesting. And thank you. Maybe. And thank you.
And I agree.
Sorry. It was a statement. My question
yes,
then,
I think,
if I have to ask
Q&A, question.
Think on Q&A,
they'll say we'll take that as a comment,
a
not a question.
Is
That's
there another
fine.
Book coming?
Next book.
Oh, well, I don't have one, but I just want to explain something that might be interesting to you. Like, as an actor, I get given a script. And there's a part. I go read the script and I go, do I like this story? Do I want a part of this story? And there's a character. Can I play this character? Can I bring something to this character that feels real? But I'm interpreting it. Someone else has written it. So I now am interpreting it and delivering it. And then they'll go to the editing room and they'll cut it in certain ways and use it, whatever they... But I'm an interpreter of someone else's work. The thing with writing that's so different is that there's a blank screen, and at the end of 2 hours, there's 500, 600, 700, 800 words, and I go, where the bloody hell did that come from? And that's all me. That's all my imagination completely. I own it totally for good, bad or indifferent. And that's the difference. One's, as an actor, I'm interpreting. As a writer, I'm completely making the thing up. Yeah.
That's a great way to describe it. Okay, next question.
And hello, I think you've just answered my question. And by the way, my 40th birthday was at a golf club in Bondi, so woohoo, congrats to you. What I was going to say is, like, you've had this integrity all the way throughout your life. And obviously it's coming through new books, it's coming through a new person. We've seen you tonight, this afternoon. Do you think that's what's held you stead as a person you are, is just holding on to your integrity all the time?
Hanging on to integrity.
I don't think you can be ever thinking about integrity. You know, I think that's someone else's view of something. I think you're just trying to be honest in every situation as to how you see or feel the thing. I mean, I guess I'm not saying that I pull this off, right? But I think the three things that are very important are kindness, generosity, and humility, which I fail at every day. However, I think they're important things to aim for. And I guess if you aim for those things, you're probably going to live a fairly truthful life. And that's not a bad thing to try and do.
Okay, we have time for one last lucky question.
I don't have a question, I have a statement. My name is Donna, and I was a bartender in New York in the 80s. And I want to thank you for making our life much, much more difficult. I didn't get to pay my student loans off as quick as I should have because everyone wanted us to see us twist the bottle. So thank you, and Mr. Cruz, too.
Lovely to see you.
I think we can agree it's been an absolute joy and a pleasure. Let's put our hands together to thank Brian Brown.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Actor, producer, working boy, done good, and of course now novelist Brian Brown, a real storyteller, a real raconteur. That was a recent literary lunch. Cassie Hamer was the other voice there, the journalist and author. She was having a chat to him. And I said before, but check it out, particularly if you're looking for a really good read this time of year. He's got his second very suspenseful crime thriller out. It's titled The Hidden. Thank you to Sandra, who texted in saying, Nick, I'm really enjoying listening to Brian Brown. I've always liked him, and I've realised how little I knew about him. It was a very deep conversation, and I like to know that he thinks so much about the work he does as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.